the first time that I was walking through the forest in Ukraine, and I came to a clearing, and in the clearing there were three men squatting over a fire. I took a sideways look at them, they took a sideways look at me, and I walked past them.
The Distance Hiker Podcast. Well, hello hikers, how are you doing today? It has been a while since I've published a episode of the Distance Hiker Podcast. I hope you are having a great day, whatever you're doing. So, a little bit of a update before I get into today's episode. You have to excuse my voice fading in and out of the microphone. I'm currently recording this on the living room floor in a less than optimal seating position, just because all the other rooms are taken and the tumble dryer's on, and this is so far the quietest room in the house. But there isn't a desk here. Anyway, so I'm hoping, no, hoping is a bad word. I am going to do frequent podcasts throughout 2022. I'm aiming for fortnightly, not doing weekly. Weekly is a lot of work, which I don't have the time for that I wish I did at the moment. So I'm going to aim for fortnightly podcasts. And currently I have quite a few guests lined up over the next coming weeks. So I've got quite a lot of content to come, some really great guests coming, and I'll reveal more about those guests as and when I speak to them and get the episodes produced. Super excited to be doing this weekly. I've really missed recording with people and speaking to the interesting guests we've had on, so I'm really, really excited to get going with the podcast again. To all of those guests who are coming on soon, can't wait to talk to you. Bring you onto the show and to share your stories, and to everybody who listens, cannot wait to share those stories with you. I have no doubt whatsoever that you will really, really enjoy them. So on to today's episode. Now, when was it? It was back in July. I noticed on the news that a lady called Ursula Martin had just finished walking 5,500 miles across Europe, starting in Ukraine. And I had to get her on the show. I thought, wow, that's cool. And she did this during lockdown as well, so two lockdowns, which was, you know, even more impressive. Especially navigating the political and the political climate, and having to stay in places for long periods of time. It wasn't easy, I can imagine. And we explored that during the talk. I bothered Ursula to death until she came on the show, which she did. Hopefully it wasn't too sympathetically, but I had a really nice chat with Ursula. It was really, really good to speak to her and to find out about her story. We spoke about the walk with loads of anecdotes and little stories, and she just gave so much information and gave so much away around her walk and her feelings around it and the logistics and, what she was doing before, what she's planning to do afterwards. And I think that this is a podcast which everybody can enjoy. Ursula's a real life person doing, something remarkable. She's totally relatable, completely lovely. And it was just great to have, Ursula on the show. So without further ado, I bring you Ursula Martin, who you can find, I think if you Google one woman walks, or go onto Instagram and just type one woman walks, you'll find her on there. So go follow Ursula, and she's bringing out a book soon as well, which she briefly mentioned in the episode, but I don't think it's ready yet. She does have one book called which is out already, which you can look at, you can find on her website. But anyway, I'm rambling on. Listen to the show. I really hope you enjoy it. And here is Ursula Martin from One Walks. Thanks for listening.
With no electricity and candlelight for my lighting, so sorry.
That was absolutely yeah. That sounds really nice. So where are you staying? It looks really unique. It looks shed-like, if you don't mind me saying.
It's Yeah, it's a shared on my friend's small holding.
Is it?
So yeah, that's where I'm staying for the couple of months of rest and recuperation. Oh, so
brilliant. Well, I guess that going from what you've been doing to having sort of all of the luxuries probably would feel a little bit overwhelming anyway. Or is this like a nice gentle come down for you, or is this for, this yeah, for a totally normal?
Because it was a useful place for me. Sorry, I'm still...
Oh, it's all right. No, honestly, you're cool. Take your time.
Recording properly, is it?
No, it should. It's fine. I can hear you absolutely loud and clear, so that should be fine. And I do it in audio anyway, so if the video is a bit funny, that's really no problem.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so don't get to worry about it too much. I'm not on video. I don't have enough time to edit video, so I'm just doing the audio at the moment. So yeah, so as long as I can hear you, we're all good. We're all good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that sounds fine then, huh?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. Okay. Yeah, brilliant. Great. You can hear me all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Hey, thanks for coming on today. I'm recording already. I hope that's okay. I set Zoom. I've not used Zoom before. I used that software I sent you, but with Zoom it started recording straight away, so I was like, okay, we'll just leave it at that. But yeah, no, thanks for coming on today, really appreciate it.
Into the podcast, that's brilliant. This more than anything will show my approach to the whole journey.
I like your approach to the journey. I feel if I ever did something like this, I would be exactly the same. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you. But yeah, I have to apologize, first of all, because I think I've been a bit persistent. I can tell you're trying to sort of disconnect and take some time out and to recharge and not be kind of doing updates every day, etc. And there's been me going, hi, I've sent you the link, and do you want to come on my podcast, and have you seen the link yet? So thanks for putting up my persistence and being here tonight. I really appreciate it.
Not at all.
It's really, not at really, all. Really fine. Great. So how are you?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm good.
Adjusting well back into normal life, whatever. I suppose
I mean normal. What the hell is normal?
What is normal for you? What is normal for you then? What does this feel?
There's no such thing.
No,
I don't have a normal. No.
And is that something you've had for a long time, where you've just not had a sort of, and I say normal, i.e. like, you know, living in a house with a 9-to-5 job, etc.? Is that something you've just not had for a long time now because of the, you know, what you do essentially?
The last time I had that was 2013. Hmm. Yeah.
And that was just before your diagnosis, if you don't mind me asking.
No, that was just after. So
just after.
I had actually been traveling. I went traveling in 2009. And then, you know, traveled for a bit, did the whole cancer thing. And so the last time that I had a normal job and was in a house at the same time, that was 2015. And that was when I'd already had the idea for the walk, the first wealth walk, and was kind of aiming for, you know, saving money. And
yeah. So that. So what was, what for you, I'm going to get straight into this if you don't mind me doing so. What for you was the point where you decided to kind of flip your life on its head and go and pursue this thing that you do, which you've, I think, rather appropriately titled as extreme walking?
Extreme rambling. Extreme rambling. It's because I don't like the term adventuring.
Okay.
I feel a bit, I don't know. I don't know if I fit being an adventurer. It all feels a bit kind of grand and heroic and, you know.
Okay, you're not the first person to say that.
Yeah. It's got turned into a brand, and I'm not really sure I like that. So I just picked Extreme Rambler as a kind of joke. When did I first, I mean, I don't, I think it's all just come slowly on itself. I made the decision to go traveling in 2008, 2009, something like that.
Okay.
And then since then, like, I've just had this sequence of life events.
Yeah.
some challenges and some obviously the traumatic event of having cancer, and but nothing has ever been like this decision to go, I am going to walk for a living and write books about it, because
it's been a sort of a build-up of just lots of little bits that you've done and ideas that you've had, and they've just strung together in a, and they've kind of just made sense as they've gone along. Is that right?
Yeah, I've just been following my nose and just seeing the next thing that happened and the next thing that happened. And what has happened is gradually, by the time I got to go into the Europe walk, I was saying to myself, yes, I am doing this more properly with a view to having a book at the end of it. And this is the first time I've ever had that.
Okay. So because the book that you wrote before, where you did your 3,700 mile walk around Wales, that came after the walk. So you didn't, I'm assuming you didn't plan to do that before you wrote the book. It sort of was an afterthought. Yeah.
No. Wow. And it was only because people were giving me such good feedback about my writing during the Welsh journey. And I started to believe that I could write a book at the end of it, and then I did. And
your writing is lovely. I mean, there's a lot of people obviously who do talk about their experiences while doing trips like this, but yours is so in depth as well. And I'll get to that in a bit, because I want to kind of find out how the hell do you do that while you're walking? Because it's really impressive that you have to find the time to do this, especially since you're doing it on a smartphone as well. That's a skill. So I'll get to that in a bit, but I'm going to go back to highlight your interest. So have you always been into outdoors and hiking and countryside and, you know, I'm not going to use the word, but rambling, adventure, etc. You know what I mean. Have you always been into this?
No, not at all.
Where did that start for you?
I don't know if I am even now. So the thing that I'm into is pushing my boundaries. And you can do that in all kinds of different ways. So when I was in my early 20s, I was living in Cardiff and I was surrounded by stoners. And so you can have the same experiences of pushing boundaries by breaking into the city centre park at 2 o'clock in the morning and smoking spliffs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so
I didn't do that, but I can see what you mean. Yeah.
Oh, me neither. Me neither. Allegedly. I mean, I'm sure you can. Yeah. But, you know, like for me, that it's that sense of pushing past expectations of what's possible.
Yeah.
And doing something wild and doing something naughty. And that can be all kinds of different kind of ways to live your life. And it just happens that, you know, I've been to lots of festivals. I've been around loads of people in the festival world who put on parties and like create festivals and events. And those are all about pushing boundaries in completely multitude of different ways, in artistic creations and in hedonistic ways as well. And for me, what I've come to in this physical sense of adventures, and for me an adventure is going into the unknown. And so that's the theme, that's the thread of my life. So it hasn't necessarily been this kind of physical athletic sense of adventuring that has always been part of my life. No.
Okay, so it's another way essentially for you to explore yourself, and hiking just happens to be the vessel in which you do that with, rather than something you've chosen because you just love hiking.
And yeah, absolutely.
So I'm assuming naturally through this you have started to develop obviously you must enjoy it to do this anyway. Is it something that you, after you finished, you go, I want to do that more? Or is there other ways you feel that you could have that sort of outlet and that ability to kind of be rebellious as such and to do something a bit wild? Or is hiking just the way that feels really comfortable for you to do that now?
I think it's definitely what I've come to as the thing that is the most pleasurable for me to do, because it's the wild sense of it.
Yeah.
And the freedom sense of it as well that I really like.
Okay.
Yeah, I enjoy both of those things.
That's super interesting. So if you don't mind me asking briefly about your cancer, and I don't want to touch on it too much because I know you're 9 years and nearly 10 years free of it soon, aren't you? Which is, I'm guessing that feels like a pretty big milestone.
Maybe I can finally forget about it.
I guess it feels like it's quite far behind you now as well, because, you know, 9-10 years is quite a long time.
It is, but it's still present because I still have to go to hospital and have checkups.
Yeah, of course.
So there is still this kind of risk.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether how real it is anymore, but because I still have to go, and just last week and I went and had a scan and a blood test. And so there is still this kind of rising and falling of tension every time you go back to hospital and, you know, is it going to come back and might it? And you just don't know. So, yeah, it's still kind of quite present for me in that sense.
And does that rise and fall in tension get any easier to deal with as it goes along, or is it something you learn to cope with?
I think it gets easier to tell myself that it's probably nothing. As time's gone on, you can kind of go, it's fine, I'm probably fine, you know, whereas three years later or 5 years later was harder.
I can imagine. And so after you had that diagnosis initially of cancer, and I said, I'm not going to touch on this too much because I think it is interesting, because it's definitely part of your story that people do kind of latch onto, because it's scary and it's, you know, been a big part of your life. What were the initial feelings about cancer, and then how did you learn to cope with that new reality? And obviously walking played a part in that. Was
So there was a lot of fear and a lot of vulnerability in my cancer experience. But I do think that, and it did make me see my body in a completely different way, because all of it, you know, my body has always been whatever I put my mind to, I will go and do. And then suddenly it was this completely different experience of your body is growing a tumor. So you have this completely different experience of what your body is. And then because immediately before, I think there are other reasons why it was so affecting as well, was because immediately before I had the cancer, I had just kayaked the length of the River Danube. I finished in the September, October, and then started the cancer stuff in January. So I was still processing this massive, that was life changing. And then I went, when I actually had the diagnosis, I'd just come back to the UK from Bulgaria for Christmas, and I was staying on a mate's sofa when I said, I've got this strange feeling in my stomach, blah, blah, blah. And then we went to the doctor. So I was actually technically kind of homeless while I underwent the cancer treatment. I ended up going to a family friend and staying with them. So it wasn't just the cancer that affected me. It was the intense feeling of vulnerability during that time as well. Not only has your body undergone this thing where it's your own body is trying to kill you, but also I didn't have my own home and I didn't have my own place to retreat. So I think that's all part of how it messed me up. There were lots of different reasons why that time was very difficult. And it's not just the tumor part of the cancer, if you see what I mean.
You must have, with that feeling and that change and how you feel about your body, I guess, fallen out of love with your body, and had to come to terms of a very different relationship with it. How did you get back to a place where you started to understand that, you know, this new, have this new relationship with you, with yourself and with your body?
I think walking has helped me massively with that, because it's a way of showing me what my body can do positively, physically, And it's an achievement. It's a physical achievement if you can go, right, I'll go. And so the first thing that I did 6 months after my surgery was I went and walked, I think it's about 400 miles down the River Severn and back up the River Wye.
Okay.
And that's my way of being normal again. And everything I've done since has served to show me my body in different ways and to get me to appreciate my body better.
And was that walk that you did your first experience of long distance walking as well?
No. So I had walked the length of a river in 2010.
Okay. Where was that?
It was the River Minho in Spain, in Galicia.
Okay.
And that was my first experience of using my body to transport myself from chosen point to chosen point.
Yeah.
In an exploratory adventure. So that was the first time that I challenged myself in that way.
Oh, wow. And what was the catalyst for that particular walk? Where did that come from? How did you, was it somebody you went with, or did you come up with walking that yourself?
I saw the river on the map and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to follow that to the source? And I, again, in that sense of why don't we break into the park and smoke loads of spliffs?
Yeah.
It's that sense of why don't I?
Yeah.
You know,
the curiosity.
What if?
Yeah.
What if I did that? And that can be art, like I said, that can be art, that can be hedonism, that can be adventure, but it's following the what if and going through with it. And so, yeah, that was the first kind of exploratory sense that I did. And I was so, I mean, I had a pair of boots that I'd found in a skip had like foam bottoms that completely wore away during the trip. I was carrying like 20 kilo because I had all my traveling stuff with me.
Yeah.
I remember coming to this bin in the woods and I left 9 vests draped over that bin because it was one of the first times because I'd kind of gone off traveling and I'd left my job and I'd kind of gone, I'm going traveling. I was 28 I think, or 29. No, I was 29 turning 30 by that point. And that was one of the first ways in which I stopped weighing myself down with kind of expectations and anticipations. Because that was the thing of like, oh, I'll have a winter coat and I'm going to Spain for the summer, but I'll need a winter coat for 6 months later, which I must carry with me now. 6 months when I don't need it. So it was this sense of like learning to let go of what you think you might need just in case.
Yes.
And just learning to just deal with just be what's me there. And my body and handling whatever comes up and not being kind of armored. It's kind of like letting go of the armor. I think that's what I'm going to have to say adventuring again, but that's what that kind of, that's what testing yourself does.
Yeah.
Is you let go of all this. A lot of people kind of hide themselves behind all the armor of, I'll take this just in case. And what if that happens? And this stop. And for me, it's been this gradual process of letting go of all the shields and just being this like kind of bare, vulnerable person and being okay.
And you seem to do that both through your person, but also obviously through what you carry then at this point. Is that a fair assessment? That's really interesting. That's really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. That's a really interesting thought on kind of how to carry yourself. And so you, after this walk that you did, you then went to walk 3,700 miles around the coast of Wales. I'm assuming you did that with very much the same mindset.
I mean, I had learned, like the book that I've written, I think, and also possibly the way that I do tell stories, I do tend to focus on my vulnerabilities and my weaknesses and the way that I'm, but I was prepared for that. And I did, you know, I'd had years of wild camping behind me. So there was an element of preparedness, but also there is that sense of just allowing it to happen.
Mm.
And just, so there is a naivety in that,
mm.
in just allowing it to happen. And I think it's really important to keep that naivety. Mm.
So I'm assuming you didn't do that particular walk with a plan in mind. Did you just go for it and just take it every day at a time, see how far you go each day, see where you want to camp, wild camp, etc. So did you do it with quite a lot of freedom, or did you do it within constraints of any sort of, I have to do this in X amount of days, doing X amount of daily mileage per day?
Well, I tried that, and then I really messed up. And so
what happened then when you tried it?
Because at that time I was arranging the journey around my hospital appointments. So the whole idea of my 3,700 mile walk in Wales was that I would walk from my home to hospital and then take 6 months walking around Wales, walk back to hospital again, and then walk home. So
it wasn't just a circumference of Wales. It was you walk partially around Wales, then back home, and then hitch a ride back to where you carried on and carry on going around again.
No. It was a complete flowing journey.
Yeah.
So you walk down the River Severn from Llantlith to Bristol.
Yes.
You walk up the Offa's Dyke Path, you walk around the coastal path, and you walk back to Bristol. Except that I also added in, that's only about 1,000 miles, and I did 3,700.
I'm going to say, because I was thinking Wales is not 3,700 miles, so there must have been something else in there. So is the hospital, the extra bits to the hospital appointments. Excuse me, sorry, added the extra mileage.
No, I added in Glyndwr's Way, the Cistercian Way, which is about 600 miles, the Cambrian Way.
Yep.
Another mountain route. I walked the length of eight rivers. So I'd walk around on the coastal path. And when I got to one river, a river that I liked, I could walk up it to the source, mm-hmm. and then over to the source of another river and back down to the coast path again. So that was like a way to carry on and make it a continuous route.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, I just kind of liked the look of all these different places. So I got excited and I kept adding things in. And then I just really, and then I did this ridiculous calculation where I thought, well, I'll walk 10 miles a day for the first month just to, you know, ease myself into it. And then, I don't know, 12 miles a day for the second month. And then I did a division, and I was like, all right, 19 and a half miles a day for the whole of the rest of the time. That seems fine.
It wasn't fine.
It wasn't at all. And it was complete idiocy that I thought it would work. Sorry, I'm just going to adjust my seat. It didn't work at all. I wound up getting plantar fasciitis because I wasn't stretching properly.
Yeah.
And so after, I don't know how long it was, 2 months, I think. 2 months, maybe 3 months. I was in loads of pain. I was really struggling to continue. And that's the part where I let go of all the targets and the pressures and the completions and the so on. And that's when it really started to work, because you let go of all the kind of frantic forcing of will against journey, and you just allow, I kind of call it, you just allow the flow of the journey to happen. Like you just let it take you over, and you just know that as long as you keep going, you'll do it, and it doesn't matter how fast you are. And I think that's,
so I'm going to interrupt you. Was the before you let go, was the schedule you set for yourself and the miles you're trying to achieve, were they externally driven kind of ideas that you had through what you kind of experienced through other people or people's suggestions, or were they just your own personality trying to just make you walk in a particular way, if that makes sense?
I think it was my kind of idiocy and inexperience of fitting. I just saw a load of paths that I wanted to do and thought, yeah, yes, I can do all of those. And this is how I will fit it into 8 months, rather than kind of thinking, what am I capable of, and then doing it. But also, I'd been, there's a long distance hiker called Carrot Quinn in the USA, who I've been reading her blogs for a really long time before she started long distance walking. And she was the only, they call it through hiking in America. So she was the only through hiker that I was really aware of. And she'd just done the PCT, the Pacific Crest Trail, twice in two different years. And she was really into ultralight backpacking. And I think that I was comparing myself to her in this sense of 25 miles a day.
Yeah.
Oh, we did 30 miles today, and that was quite a stretch. And then I was like, ugh, I can't even do 18. I'm so pathetic, you know, and so there was that as well. And I really had to, that is my natural state, is competitiveness and like self-hatred. That's my base kind of emotion.
It's very easy to get to that though, as a human anyway. It's very easy to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so having the kind of the injury of the plantar fasciitis forced me to drop all that I just kind of had this realization that I just do what I can do and don't worry about it, or worry about it as little as possible.
That is really, really interesting. Really glad I asked you that question now. So I'm going to move on to another one. And this amused me. So I was reading your bio on your website, and I think you probably explained this already. And you describe yourself as a confused and disorganized man. And I think I've always described myself as something similar, just not in those same words. I'd love to know what you mean about that and how that kind of has influenced your decisions so far. Has that aided you in just perhaps like an ignorance to just go and do these things when you wouldn't otherwise have done them? How does that work for you, being confused and disorganized in your life? Because I don't think they're bad traits necessarily.
I don't think I am. Like, basically, I just really hate bios and describing.
Okay, have I read into this too much?
A little bit. No, yeah. Well, no, because it's my own fault for putting it out there. But yeah. I really hate the ways that you have to big yourself up.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
When you write a magazine article. That's what I liked about it. You didn't elevate yourself in this sort of way which you weren't comfortable to do so. Because I'm the same. I struggle with bias because I think I don't know what to write about myself. So I liked that honesty about yourself in it.
Yeah. I know. I think I just get this thing where if I kind of have to destroy what people think of me. And I don't know if that makes sense at all, but if I think that people are judging me for doing something, I kind of do more of it sometimes. It's a really bad character trait. So where I had to write this bio that's like, right, big yourself up and say great things about yourself, I'm like, well, fuck you. I'm going to say really bad things about myself. So,
It came across really well. So it might have backfired a bit because it was just great. Okay, so I'm reading into this too much. That's fine. I'll move on now.
I am a bit. I mean, I don't think I'm disorganized.
Yeah.
Especially not in, you know, because if you're going to do something like walk across Europe or walk 3,500 miles, you can. I think that when people go, oh, I just picked up a bag and set off, I do think that it kind of sometimes it can hide quite a lot of secret planning. You know, I could not have done what I did without being organized about it.
I'll jump to the organizer because it was one of my questions. So how going to the latest walk you've done, which was 5,000 miles from Ukraine to Wales. How did you go about planning? Actually, first question is before, where did that idea come from? And then how did you go about planning that?
Well, basically I kayaked the length of the Danube in 2011. And at that point, I had ideas of continuing to Ukraine, come to the mouth of the Black Sea, and I saw Crimea kind of ahead of me, and I thought, what would happen if I kayaked to Crimea? And then obviously cancer got in the way and life changed completely. But I'd always had this idea, there was this sense, because I had this house sit in Bulgaria for the winter. All the possessions that I had were in that house sit. I hitchhiked back to the UK for a Christmas visit, and then started the whole cancer thing. So I never went back to Bulgaria. So there was this sense of kind of life being chopped in half with this before cancer thing. And there was this unfinished business of a further journey in Europe. So that's where the idea came from. And as I was coming to the end of the Welsh walk, there was this kind of sense of, crap, what now? You know, what do I do next? And that's when the idea came, is I could walk across Europe. So it was there from 2015. And then I'd set off in 2018. So, you know, you need to raise money. You need to buy your kit. You need to anticipate what everything's going to be like. You know, what pieces of kit are you going to need for what terrain and season and so on?
Also, all sorts of preparation.
And
what about actually planning the route itself? Did you have an idea of where you were going to walk, and things like maps as well? Because obviously we're lucky with having amazing maps in the UK, but I'm assuming in some parts of Europe, and many parts of the world, the mapping just isn't as good as what we have here. How did you navigate that? Or how did you navigate the maps that you had, for example?
I will admit to being a little bit confused and disorganized about mapping.
I wouldn't know where to start. So where would you start if you're looking at doing something in Europe?
Well, at that point, I'd never used GPS, or I'd never used electronic mapping. I did the whole Welsh walk with map. Well, I didn't use a compass in Wales because you kind of don't need to. I'm sure people would shriek at that statement, but I just used maps in Wales. So I wanted to use paper maps for the whole thing. But yeah, like you're saying, there's the massive problem of access to them. And actually I got, so there's a really good, obviously the Stanfords, and there's a really good, very small shop in Upton-on-Severn, and they're called the mapshop.co.uk. They have a fantastic selection of maps. So I got a few before I went into Ukraine, and then got the rest in Kiev. But they were only one in 250,000.
Yeah, that's not for the whole of the temple.
But fortunately,
it doesn't tell you where the styles are and the fences are and things, does it?
Well, they had no contour lines on it. It was basically a road map,
right?
Except that all the roads between the villages where I was walking were dirt tracks anyway. So they weren't roads.
But they were at least permissive places you could walk down without cutting through somebody's land.
I mean, I did a bit, and the sense of what is private land is very different to the UK. So there's very little in the way of fences or get off my land, and quite often the animals are shepherded there, so there's no kind of fences with animals grazing inside it, so you're not kind of climbing stuff, and the animals are just moving through the landscape with people guarding them, so it's just different. There's lots that's different about what you might expect the land to be. So I made my way across Ukraine with paper maps and compass, which was just great. It was really great. And then Romania was paper maps, and then I couldn't really get any for Bulgaria. So that's when I started moving to electronic mapping, and mostly used ViewRanger for the whole of the rest of the journey.
Okay.
And in terms of the actual route, I just knew that I wanted to go from Kiev to Bulgaria, and there are only two places to cross the Danube. in Bulgaria. So I wanted to go to Rusa in the east. And I knew that I wanted to walk the Camino to Santiago.
Mm.
So really, then you had Bulgaria to the Pyrenees was unknown. And I'd had a look at, there's a route called the Via Dinarica,
okay.
which goes through the Balkans. But really, it was making it up. I did just make it up as I went along. And sometimes it would be week by week, sometimes day by day, you know, just in terms of you knew more or less which direction you were going for, but as to, you know, which forest track do you follow is just making it up, really.
Yeah. And
it's fine, because when you're not on a specific route, you're not lost either when you're not on
it. That's true. I mean, were there any periods or times where you had walked a particular way and you came across something that was impassable that you didn't know about, or generally were you able just to walk quite freely through those landscapes?
Oh yeah, like annoying stuff like that is always happening.
Yeah,
it's just part of it.
Yeah, of course. And how did that access and change as you went through Europe? Did you find that it got more restrictive as you kind of got into Spain, for example, than it was further back in Ukraine?
Absolutely. The richer the country is, the more keep out signs you'll see.
Really.
I didn't see my first private property sign until Ukraine.
Really?
Until Croatia, sorry.
Okay.
From Ukraine to Croatia, not a single keep out, anything like that. And then you get into like south of France and it's just chock-a-block, you know. Then you get to like the cameras on people's doors and the high fences and the you know, keep out. And in the UK as well, actually, it's a significant amount of controlling of public behavior.
Yeah,
I don't think we kind of realize in Britain how under the thumb we are in terms of public behavior expectations.
That's really interesting, actually. So doubts before you started that walk, were there any points in which you sort of that negative self-talk comes in and you think, well, I could do this, but I could do this instead, or it might, you know, it seems a bit difficult. Were there any kind of points you started making excuses for yourself, or is that not something that kind of comes to you?
I don't really feel No, I've never really doubted whether I wanted to do it or whether I could do it.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. That's really interesting. I know I would probably, you know, I live in my sort of golden prison here a little bit, I'll be honest, you know, 9-to-5 job, you know, this is my creative outlet. And I certainly, if I did something like that, would have a ton of self-doubt about mortgage, kids, you know, family, job, etc. That must be really liberating to not have that and just to be able to go, well, actually I think I want to do this walk, and you know, actually I'm going to follow through with it.
What I have. I think a question that like a lot of journalists ask me is why are you doing this, and they want to frame it as if I'm this really out there person for having decided to do this crazy thing. And I don't see it that way, because like you're saying, I think lots of people have these crazy ideas and they can't do them because they're held back by their existing obligations. And it just so happens that my life has taken the route it's taken, and I don't have a mortgage, a career, or a relationship, or children. So I was free to pick the what if, the dream idea. But also I've shaped my life to achieve those things as well. So when I finished the Welsh walk, I mean, I have some crazy statistic about my life.
I love a good statistic, Anne.
It's something like I've paid rent for 1.5 years out of the last 12.
Wow. That's a truly nomadic existence.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
And it's either it's being on the adventures or it's finding ways to avoid having to earn a proportion of income to pay it out on rent. So that can be house sitting, that can be van living, that can be my living situation at the moment where I exchange gardening time.
Okay.
You know, so I've chosen not to shackle myself just as much. You know, I don't have a nice car and I don't have all the things that other people kind of think are necessary for their existence and actually aren't. So it does take this kind of dedication as well, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting because, you know, I'm not going into this too much, but I just want to make an observation. We have, as a society, and I think we all know this, created, there is normality in, you know, people like myself. Yet when you do something which is not that, you know, where you live in a way which is very free, I'd say, that comes across as unusual. And I think it's a shame that is unusual, because it shouldn't be like that. The way you live is, if you don't mind me saying, beautiful. It's such a lovely way to have an existence and a rich life that you have of doing all these things. And that should be celebrated as normal and something that people can do. But, you know, it's just not. So, you know, this is why I'm really enjoying this and talking to you, because it's just so nice to hear that you're making the most of this and kind of it's just become normal day-to-day life of yours is walking and adventuring. I know you heard that word, you know, and writing, gritting your teeth at me. That's just my observation. I think it's just super interesting. So were there any points on the walk where you felt unsafe? Now, I noticed some of the reporters who were writing about you like to talk about wolves and things, but there was never any expansion on that story or where wolves came into that, or, you know, any sort of wildlife. When did you feel unsafe in this trip?
The first time that I was walking through the forest in Ukraine and I came to a clearing, and in the clearing there were three men squatting over a fire.
Okay.
And I took a sideways look at them, they took a sideways look at me, and I walked past them. And just in that vulnerability of you know, being a woman and what you're going to do and so on. And then something in me, I was like, I think I'm going to go and ask them for directions. And I went back, and they'd come into the woods because it was one of their birthdays. So they were all older. They were all like 50s.
Yeah.
And every single guy in Ukraine, by UK standards, outside the cities, pretty much all of the men just looked dodgy as hell. Like, they looked so rough.
Yeah.
Because, you know, British, like, there's different, like, historical standards of healthcare, quite a lot of facial scarring quite often in Ukraine for some reason, and gold teeth as well. So they just all look rough as hell.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I think I'm going to go and ask them for directions. And I did, and they were really nice.
Yeah.
And they, and then we sat, we ate some food together, and we drank a little bit of rakia together, and I think I was translating on my phone a little bit so that we could talk to each other.
Sure.
So anyway, so that's not a story about being scared, but that moment of being scared, I was intimidated. And then it changed. Hearing wild boar in the tent at night, hearing wild boar around my tent is always quite scary because they just sound horrific.
What do they sound like? Is it just the squealing that they make? Or
monsters? No, they don't squeal. They grunt, and they have this when they hear something unusual. They'll do a grunt that sounds like a growl.
Yeah,
they sound like they're growling. They sound like bears almost, and that probably is this kind of response to danger. how like hanging off mountains and you've gone a bit the wrong way and you're like suddenly like clambering and you start to think, if I died, how long would it take to find the body? You know, that kind of like,
that
you have these little flashes of like, this isn't very safe.
Yeah, being that far removed from anybody and immediate help, I guess, is a risk.
Exactly. And when you're like trying to maneuver an ungainly body and an ungainly rucksack up sheer rocks and, you know, you're just kind of clambering up and down mountains, that can be a bit sometimes, just if it goes a bit wrong and sometimes somehow you're on this like dodgy dodgy little bit of the path. Usually I lose the path and then I'm trying to find it again, and then you end up in some really crappy little place. It happened to me this afternoon.
Okay. where were you this afternoon?
Oh my God, on the Glyndwr's Way.
All right, of all places,
So some friends came to walk.
Yeah.
And I invited them into my place for a cup of tea, and then we walked off up the hill, and I walked with them further on one path, and I thought, well, I can cut across to the top of the hill and then join my usual, I've got a little 4 or 5 mile route around from where I'm staying. And I found myself like clambering through thick pine forest, which is all the undergrowth with all the moss and the branches and, you know, pushing through pine branches. I've got pine needles in my hair. I'm just going to show you.
All right, yeah. You'll sleep like, with those digging into the back of your neck.
They've all gone down the back of my neck. So there was, and that's that moment of losing the path, and you just carry on a bit and you think, oh, this will be fine, I'll carry on. And then it's sunk cost fallacy. So you carry on with it for far too long and you're too proud to take a wrong turning back again. And then, I do that so often.
Yeah, so that adds to it though, doesn't it? That's all part of the experience and you get through it. I mean, so you did this walk and you walked to Finisterre and then you carried on up the Camino, didn't you?
I turned around to different Camino,
So at what point along, it was when you were walking the Camino that COVID turned up at our doorstep, is that right?
Oh, it was way earlier than that. Walking the Camino in January to March, from January 2021, I was walking Camino.
Okay.
My pandemic hit in Italy.
Okay. Oh, right. So way back before that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Couldn't quite get the timeline right. Okay. So the Camino hit in Italy, but you got to France before you had to lock down.
Yeah. Yeah, the lockdown happened in Italy, and I was so close to the border with France, and I couldn't get anywhere to stay in Italy. The hotels were closed.
Yeah.
So I was just like, "Well, shit. I guess
is this
I'll."
The first Italy lockdown.
The first Italy lockdown.
So that was the one where we were all watching, thinking, "Oh no, hang on, this is real. This is coming our way."
Yeah. At that moment there wasn't a lockdown in France, so I thought if I can just get into France I'll be okay. This will all blow over in a few weeks. So I came out of Italy and into France, and then arrived in France about 3 or 4 days before they announced their lockdown.
And you managed to find somewhere to stay
in France? I did, yeah. I had a holiday home of a friend's sister.
Yeah.
So I was on lockdown for 93 days.
93 days. And how did you, now I was listening to another podcast you did with somebody, and from what you said in that podcast, it was a struggle, you know. How did you cope with that? Because you said you suffered from intense loneliness, you know, being in a small village in somebody's holiday home in France. On your own, especially after doing this adventure, how did you deal with that for 90 days?
I mean, nothing.
Or did you?
Handed.
Did you deal with it?
I mean, like in some ways, no. Yeah. I drank wine and then tried to not drink wine. Yeah. So basically, this is how I dealt with it.
Yeah.
A checklist.
Okay. What, well, a daily checklist of?
Daily checklist of healthy behaviours.
Okay.
And one of which was exercise and one of which was no alcohol. So I got a little tick if I hadn't drunk that day.
Okay.
And God, there were all kinds of things on there. Had I left the house, you know, that was a good...
Yeah.
Had I gone for a walk, so I could, because you could do exercise indoors, but had I gone for a walk, when did I last change the sheets? That was another one, because you know, time passes and you have no idea when you last changed the sheets.
Pleasant luxury, isn't it?
Like vortex of every day was just the same. so yeah, I had this, that was how I managed to do it, to stop just all the days just being this kind of blur of like just awfulness.
Yeah.
And I baked lots of cakes as well.
Oh, that's that's a good coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I
knew it was going to be hard.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah.
And all I could do was just try my best not to, I don't know, to make it less difficult. That's all I could do. And I got through it.
And you've managed to avoid further lockdowns since?
No, I had another two after that.
Okay, which countries were they in? Yeah. And were they quite as long as well?
No, not quite. I had, after the first lockdown, I think it was kind of mid-July, I managed to get back to the Alps, start walking again. I walked all the way across the south of France and then into the Pyrenees, and I walked the length of the Pyrenees through September and October. No, October and November. And then it was, when was it? No, it was September, October, because then November, December, there was another French lockdown.
Okay.
And at that point, I had this decision to make of, do I go into Spain and avoid the French lockdown? Mm-hmm. But Spain also had rising numbers at that point, and they had closed regional borders, and things were looking quite kind of worrying there as well. So I decided to just go and do the second lockdown in Spain, in France, and hopefully let things kind of calm down. Did in Spain,
go back to the same place in France again that you were in before?
No, by that time I'd met some people in the Pyrenees, and so I went to stay there. At a place in the Pyrenees.
Oh, brilliant.
Which was great again. Yeah. So there was this sense of what I always had from that point on was this kind of where's my last known place of safety? I guess it's like having I don't really know much about climbing, but you have like
your anchor points.
Yeah. So if I fall, I'm only going to swing back to this place. I had all these kind of people, you know, I knew that once I crossed the Pyrenees, I wouldn't go back to Provence, for example. I'd kind of stop. So I had this, these people in the Pyrenees to go and stay with. And by that time, things had eased in Spain. So just about over Christmas, I entered into Spain, and the final lockdown was 1 month in Ponferrada, which wasn't really imposed, but in the region ahead, they'd really shut a lot of things down, and they were asking people to stay in their houses, and all the bars and restaurants were closed.
Yeah.
And it just didn't feel right for me to go and walk there. So I waited one final month, which was the month of February, and then and that's it. So it's been 6 months on lockdown.
Wow, it's quite a significant amount of time, especially spending that abroad as well.
Yeah.
And then after you finished that final period of lockdown in Spain, you got to Finisterre, where you could start the long walk up the Camino.
Yeah. Okay. The return right up until Finisterre. And even after, really, I thought that I was going to walk back across Spain and then up through France and back to Britain that way. But as I was turning around and heading away from Finisterre, they were talking about closing regional borders in Spain. in, oh, I keep mixing up the countries. They were talking about closing regional borders in France as well.
Okay.
So I was heading into more restrictions in France and more inability to cross borders and more inability to walk freely. So at that point, I made the decision to walk to Santander and cross from Santander to Portsmouth and finish the walk that way, walk from Portsmouth to Wales.
So arriving in...
It felt like the right thing to do completely. Yeah.
And then arriving in Portsmouth, back in the United Kingdom after how many years were you gone by that point?
The whole journey had been 2 years, 9 months.
2 years, 9 months is a long time away from, you know,
yeah,
your home country. Where, how did that feel getting back into Portsmouth? Did it feel familiar?
I saw people playing bowls.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, yeah, the thing is kind of how immediately familiar it feels. It doesn't feel strange for very long, a lot of it. And then you've just got bad coffee everywhere and you've got expensive food.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You know, it's not all this glorious welcome home. You're like, God, this is a shithole, what is this?
Yeah, it's not a parade waiting at the port for you to come back. Was there anybody waiting for you to come back when you got off the boat?
Can you
let people know you were turning up, or did you just continue as you were without too much thought about it?
Oh, at that point, I had to quarantine for 2 weeks.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah, so there was a whole, like, there was still COVID drama happening.
Did you have to do the hotel thing?
No, thank goodness.
Okay.
I could go to family home.
Hmm.
I got a lift, so my ferry ticket got cancelled at about a week before I was due to travel. And then there was some frantic scrabbling, and I managed to find some friends who were driving back from Portugal and took me in their camper van. So they took me right up to the centre of England and dropped me off at a service station, and I was taken home by my sister. And then quarantined for 2 weeks, and then carried on.
Must have been a nice kind of just stop for 2 weeks, just to, you know, or was it frustrating that you were kind of made to stop frustrating?
It was frustrating. My body was in no fit state to stop.
Okay, is that because you're just in the flow of walking and you just weren't ready to stop at that point?
I was exhausted. Like emotionally exhausted. Physically, I was really struggling by that point. When I left Finisterre, I just started to be in a lot of pain. Just some of my muscles were just cramping, and I couldn't stop pain in my body by that point. And I tried walking more slowly, but it's still, I was just tired and grumpy. And then I stopped for 2 weeks. No, whatever it was, 10 days quarantine. 5 days. I think I only had 5 days because I did the test to release early. But anyway, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to rest properly. And it wasn't enough. It was a horrible break. And so I started again from Portsmouth, and I was in loads of pain. My whole body just hurt, my shoulders, my hips, my calves. About 4 days after Portsmouth was the worst. Like, I just had I couldn't move my arms.
No.
I couldn't cross my arms across my body because my shoulder blades just had knives stuck underneath them. And if I'd been able to just push through, because it took me about 2 weeks to walk from Portsmouth to Mid Wales. And after about 10 days, you're back in the swing of it. So what I really hated was the stopping and starting, because you can kind of get your body into this zone. And it was awful just stopping and then starting again. And that was when the pain would come, and it was just, ugh.
And what route did you take when you got back through into Portsmouth to Wales?
Just quite a few different footpaths. I didn't really pick one in particular. I just found a few that suited. Just,
again, look at the map, see what looks interesting, follow it.
Okay.
That's really interesting. So you're now back in Wales. Now, I'm going to ask you a question about finances, if you're okay to answer that, because I think it's easy to skim over it. Now, you afford this through Patreon and savings, if I'm correct. That's obviously, you know, not making you you're not a wealthy person who's able to afford these trips. This is, you know, you scrape it together to make this happen, which is really interesting in itself. You know, if you don't mind me asking, and you don't have to answer this question, roughly how much did you have in the bank? Roughly, give me like the nearest thousand before even starting this 5,000 mile walk.
I started with 12.
Okay.
And I finished with 5.
You finished with 5. So you really, really kind of scrimped and saved and kind of did it on a, what's the word? Bootstrap. You bootstrapped as you went and didn't sort of kind of splurge on anything. Did you manage to get, how did you manage to do that? What were your kind of tips for somebody who might be thinking of doing something similar? And obviously, you know, not everybody has money to spend a fortune on long distance walks. What would your suggestion be for those people?
Leave with enough. So don't try and, I think I was really lucky to get the Patreon to the degree that it did help me, because it never ever covered all of my costs, but it would sometimes cover about 75% of my monthly outgoing.
And if you don't, what was your monthly outgoing, if you don't mind me asking?
Sometimes, I mean, in Ukraine,
obviously would vary, wouldn't it?
Yeah, massively. Yeah. Between 45 and £200 a week.
Okay. Because that is still quite a lot of monthly outgoing, considering you're not paying a rent or a car.
Yeah, yeah. It just seemed to happen that, because once you've been going for long enough, stuff starts breaking. So it doesn't take, like, it seemed like for the second half of the journey, you'd be spending about £100-150 a month on something would happen. And also there'd be postage back to the UK would be quite a chunk. So whenever I had to post something back or forth, that would be like a 40 quid or a 50 quid. So there was something like that regularly enough, because I don't know how it, you just do your, I don't know how you would, you just have to keep money in mind all the time and basically just don't splurge.
Yeah.
And always eat from supermarkets and don't go to restaurants. And I don't know.
Was that something that you enjoyed doing, like the frugality of it, or something you wish that you didn't have to do and think about?
I think it becomes second nature. And I think that through living on a budget for a very long term, you get to, there are certain ways of things that are that other people would just call normal pleasures that are luxuries. And also I think you just don't really need much. I think I got to the point where you're like, spend money on what you need to spend money on. So if you need to get a hotel, don't worry about it. Get a hotel, because that's what you need in this moment. And I probably could have
beat yourself up about it.
And I think I probably could have done a lot more to do things like couch surfing, or try and get free beds in different places, or like sometimes there'd be hostels, but actually hostels are quite horrible to stay in, because they're bunk beds and you can't sit up in them and you can't stretch. And so it got to this point in the journey where it was just kind of like, I just want my own space, quiet space for a night, get a hotel rather than a hostel. So in a sense, it turned in, I mean, obviously it's not a luxurious journey, but I don't think I was really suffering, you know, like you could have just done couch surfing and skip diving.
Yeah. It wasn't an Into the Wild experience where you left with nothing, you know. You had enough to move forward each day, you know, with food in your belly and knowing that you had somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was this guy, I met another pilgrim on the Camino, and I described to him like what I was doing and what my budget was. And he was like, oh yeah, you could probably live on about half of that. Because he was kind of like in this sense of living as cheaply as possible, you could have lived on about half what I was living on. But, you know, I'm 41 now.
Yeah.
Like, I want my creature comforts.
Yeah. And it's individual as well. How you choose to do it's individual. So if you want to live on, you know, double that and you can afford to, that's fine. But no, thank you for answering that. Because I think it's, I always feel it's, I do ask most people sort of in terms of finances, how do they afford it? Because I think it's important to have that conversation, because there is such a big gap in there's lots of people who walk long distances and do things like what you're doing, but there's just such a big gap in how people do it. And I think you can look at somebody who is, you know, walking with no money at all, you know, and compare yourself to somebody who's walking with, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds in the bank. And it's nice to know that there's such a range of that in between. So no, thanks for answering that for me. Couple more questions, because I realize we've gone over the hour. Yeah, so I hope that's all right. So I'll wrap up soon. I don't want to keep for too long. One two final things I want to ask is social media. Obviously, you've broadcast, for use of a better word, your journey on social media for this particular trip. Is that something that kind of came easy to you, or just something you started just doing to friends and family and then it blossomed from there? Because you're quite a big following. You've got media attention from it, you know, front page on the BBC News, which was how I found out about you and thought, oh, I need to speak to this person. She seems super interesting. You know, how has that been in terms of managing the social media and also managing, I guess, the disconnect which you want to have while doing this as well?
Once I decided to start using social media, it came quite naturally. So I hadn't used it at all. I didn't have any accounts or anything until I started to do the idea of the Welsh Walk came about. And because that was for charity, that was why I started to document my journey and, you know,
to create some interest and therefore donations to the charity.
It was for ovarian cancer. But it turns out that it's something that I can do quite naturally, and it's a storytelling sense of it, I think, where you're basically telling the story in installments and in ways that keeps it fresh and inviting, and I do enjoy it as well. And actually the connection that I had with my social media following was fantastic throughout the walk.
I can tell from the comments you get every time you post something. So lovely.
People really connect with what I was doing, and they were so supportive and so heartfelt and profound, and I just really like it. Really affects me when people say stuff like that, because you don't really realize what you're doing, you know. You're just putting stuff out there and you just carry on, and it kind of becomes a habit. And then people giving it back to you, they're giving energy back to you, and it's really wonderful. So I'm really glad that I do it. But at the same time, when I got really tired throughout Spain, I found it really difficult, and I did have to kind of step away from lots of updating, because I just felt, I don't know, something just started to feel wrong about it. I didn't like doing it. I guess that was when I was starting to feel really vulnerable, and I couldn't. You have to be careful how much you moan or how much you show weakness on social media, because people have a tendency to react to it in the wrong way. They want to give you advice and they want to make it stop. And part of the point of this journey is that in any endurance journey, I think you can't make it stop. The point is that you carry on through it. You know, whereas people will go, oh, have you tried this kind of socks? And I think you should take a rest. And I think you should get your thyroid checked. And, oh, you look exhausted. And you're like, shut the fuck up. This is the point. You know, the suffering is the point.
I think at that point, you just want somebody to listen rather than to have a load of advice coming your way. If you're
For me, it's part of the documentation of the journey. This is part of the story of the journey. is the suffering and the stubbornness and the sticking with it. But people can't hold those emotions when you give them, when you broadcast them, and they want to tell you something to make you change it. And it's quite frustrating in that sense, because you're like, I can't change it, and I'm not going to, because it's the point. And so, so I've stepped away from it a little bit. I think when I was really suffering, I stopped sharing everything.
And did that help when you stopped sharing to get through that difficult patch?
I guess it just was one less thing to kind of monitor or worry about, or, you know, one less thing to do. And I just needed to kind of get my head down and get on with it.
There's a sense of when things get too much, and this applies for everything, just, you know, what baggage can you drop? What can you strip down to kind of focus on what's important right now? So I guess you did that in some way. So now you're home and you've done this walk. Are you thinking about the next thing? Are you moved on to the next thing, or are you just staying present where you're at the moment? You're smiling like there's something that, I'm not sure where this is going. Is either something coming up, or you're not sure?
Well, no, it's just that it's a natural question that everybody has.
Of course, yeah.
I think I've got around it. Basically, I've decided to walk from Land's End to John O'Groats this winter.
In the winter?
Okay. So it's,
well, I guess walking throughout the year is no stranger to you. So
no problem.
Probably nothing, yeah.
So it's basically to mark the 10-year anniversary of the cancer, which is why it has to be specifically happening on these dates. And it was really helpful for me not to just have nothing coming up, because I'm not really ready to think about, do I want to go and walk around the world? If I did have a journey in mind, it might be UK to New Zealand. I think that would be quite a cool one.
Wow. Has anybody done that?
There's a guy, I can't remember his first name. Bogle is his surname. And how annoying, we follow each other on Instagram. Anyway, he's just done it, and that took him 5 years.
Okay, wow.
Other people have done it, I'm sure of it.
So there's definitely ideas brewing, but immediately.
To be honest, I've finished the journey in such an awful kind of physical state. And I did struggle. You know, I wasn't, like, it was very lonely, and I don't necessarily know whether I want this to be my whole life, of like going and disappearing for another 5 years with no home. So at the moment, I don't feel like I want to go and do anything at all. And I've just said to myself that I'm going to write this book, live here, you know, be in my community, be with my friends, be around people I love, and see what happens, and not make any decisions just yet.
Not put any pressure on yourself to feel you have to do the next big thing and beat what you did previously.
That's really interesting. Not to leave again. I don't want to leave again. I've only just got back, and
of course,
I'm not ready to go and do this all again yet. But maybe I will. I'm not discounting it, because it kind of become a little bit of an urge after a while, but which is why
you're focusing on where you're at right now. Trying to be present with that set of feelings you have about, actually, I'm enjoying being stationary. Stopping.
Make connections and see what happens.
That's brilliant. Well, I think we'll finish on that, because that sounds like a good stopping point. Really enjoyed
it.
Well, keep us updated with your progress. I will, of course, put this podcast on the Facebook group which I run. So you'll definitely get some followers from there and some more interest. So, and I'll be keeping an eye on what's next, because I've got a suspicion that, you know, you're obviously doing Land's End, John O'Groats, but I think from what I've seen so far, you may get itchy feet again in a little while. But no, I hope you enjoy the recovery and just slowing down and that wonderful shed that you're living in, which does look really nice, actually. Got shed envy right now.
Yeah, it's great. I love it.
It looks lovely. Yeah, it just looks really kind of cut off and, yeah, cozy. So I hope you're, you recover well. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
No, it's no problem at all. All right. We'll speak soon and I'll update you when this is online as well.
Okay. Great.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. Nice to talk to you.
All right. You too.
All right. Cheers. Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Distance Hiker podcast. Please don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts from. There's a lot of places beyond Spotify and Apple, but I think they're the main ones. But anyway, if you enjoyed the show, why not let me know, or Isla know even. We'd love to hear from you. But until next time, take care of yourself and thanks for listening in. Thank you.